Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council and your moderator for this forum. Tonight, Dr. Farhad Sabatan will share with us the history, tenets, and values of the Baha'i faith, which upholds the unity of God and the oneness of the human race. The Baha'i faith was founded in 19th century Persia by the prophet and founder Baha'u'llah. It is the second largest minority religion in Iran, but its adherents continue to be discriminated against in Iran and elsewhere. Its holy shrines and offices are in Israel. Our presenter, Dr. Farhad Sabatan, holds a PhD in economics from UC Davis. He is a lecturer in economics at Cal State East Bay. He's a human rights defender and is the spokesperson for the Baha'i international community. So without further ado, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Farhad Sabatan.
Good evening, and thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Pappas. It's an honor and a pleasure for me to be here tonight. Allow me to thank the Commonwealth Club of California for the opportunity to talk about the Baha'i faith, whose adherents have been and continue to be persecuted in the land of its birth in Iran. When innocent people are subjected to repression, intimidation, harassment, tyranny, and abuse, it is certainly organizations such as the Commonwealth Club and conscious media such as National Public Radio and other media as such that make an effort to put a spotlight on the atrocities that are being leveled against minorities in Iran. By doing so, they are showing that the arrest, the interrogations, the torture, the killings of innocent people is not going unnoticed. So before I get to the details of the persecution of the Baha'is in Iran, which is the second half of my presentation tonight, I would like to share with you some basic summary of the beliefs of the Baha'i faith and the tremendous challenge that they are facing in Iran. We look at the planet Earth from outer space, and we see a blue planet in its complete wholeness. No borders, no social divisions, no class distinctions, no racial tensions, no religious strife, and essentially nothing that would imply or signify otherness. It is as if this planet is home to a large, diverse family of human race who are here to live, to learn, to develop, to grow, and prosper, and make their home a better place to live. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the essence of the Baha'i faith, to raise the consciousness of the oneness and wholeness of humankind, and to effect a deeper understanding of the concept of unity in diversity and a framework for its realization. This basic and fundamental notion is the message of Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, who declared his mission in the middle of the 19th century in Persia. He stated, "We verily have come to unite and weld together all that dwell on earth. The fundamental purpose animating the faith of God and his religion is to safeguard the interests and promote the unity of the human race and to foster the spirit of love and fellowship amongst men. Suffer it not to become a source of dissension and discourse, of hate and enmity. Our hope is that the world's religious leaders and the rulers thereof will unitedly arise for the reformation of this age and the rehabilitation of its fortunes. Let them, after meditating on its needs, take counsel together and through anxious and full deliberation administer to a diseased and sorely afflicted world and remedy it as required. If we pause to reflect on this statement, we will see the grave responsibility that has been put on the secular and religious leaders of the world. So consider for a moment the birth of a child. In Afghanistan, another child in Sweden, another child in Zimbabwe, and another child in Bolivia. Simply because of a geographical accident, each child is likely to face a different future because of the country in which he or she was born. Consider the following statistics that is being shown. This statistic has been extracted from a database of UNESCO. And it shows, for example, that when a child is born in Afghanistan, under the second column, you see that the mortality rate of children in Afghanistan is 134 out of 1,000, and in Sweden it's 2. When you see the life expectancy at birth of children, a child in Afghanistan, when he or she is born, is expected to live only 44 years. In Sweden, 81 years. In Bolivia, 66 years. The primary school enrollment, we see that in Afghanistan, only 61% of children are enrolled in school for education, whereas in Sweden, 95%. Now, we can essentially randomly select different nations of the world, and this statistic applies to them. And what it says is, depending on where a child is born, essentially the destiny of that child is already predetermined, simply because of a geographical accident. I doubt if any of us would believe that any of these children are any less smart or intelligent than the other at the moment of birth. I'm sure there are students or there are children who have different degrees of intelligence which has nothing to do with where they were born. I also doubt if any one of us would find this acceptable if instead of having these children born in different countries of the world, if they were actually, we would see this type of statistics in different states in the United States. That would never be accepted or tolerated by us. Yet, in one of the darkest pages of the Iranian history, when tyranny and backwardness characterized the Iranian society of the 19th century, Baha'u'llah brought a vision that was as unique and revolutionary then as it is now. It's a concept of world citizenship. He said, "The earth is but one country, and mankind its citizen." This principle by no means implies that we should abandon a sane and genuine patriotism, as one's love for one's country does not imply disloyalty or disregard for one's city or one's family. Because I am a U.S. citizen does not mean that I'm going to hate San Francisco. In fact, I love San Francisco. However, this pivotal principle does expand the extent and the scope of our inclusiveness. It gives us a vision about the challenge we face and the noble goals we are to achieve. It calls for committing to a wider loyalty we call our global village. Again, in this respect, Baha'u'llah wrote, "My object is none other than the betterment of the world and the tranquility of its people." The well-being of mankind, its peace and security are unattainable unless and until its unity is firmly established. This idea, which you see here, is the central theme of the Baha'i faith, for which Baha'u'llah, the founder, was put in prison for the duration of his life. From his prison cell, he wrote to kings and rulers of the earth at that time, inviting them to use their power and authority to abandon war and remove division and strife, and to bring peace and reconciliation. He likened the world of humanity to a human body, which is composed of diverse cells and organs. The human body is one, and its wholeness is owed to the variety and diversity of cells. Yet the cells may perceive their existence as neglecting the rest of the body. They may neglect the whole, and they perceive that they are all different cells and they're all different organs. They may fight with each other because they are cells of men and women, black and white and yellow, young and old, Muslim, Christian, Jews, or Hindu, speak different languages, or come from different cultural heritage. Yet recognition of this pivotal concept is what Baha'is strive to share, and it is in this sense that Baha'u'llah has emphasized that the well-being of mankind, its peace and security, is unattainable unless and until its unity is firmly established. So, what are the obstacles that we are facing when we want to achieve these objectives? What is the framework in which the Baha'is try to do this? So, all religions have tried to contribute to bringing peace and bringing unity. Unfortunately, we see that throughout history, the followers of religion, for some reason, have abandoned that initial thought of religion. Religion by itself, the word means to reunite. Religio means to reunite. Yet, unfortunately, we see that there are Sunni Muslims who fight Shia Muslims and vice versa. There are Catholics and Protestants that fight with each other, not because they're following, you know, Jesus Christ, but because they are deviating from what has been said. We see that Muslims hate Jews and Jews fight with Muslims and Hindus and so on and so forth. So, the Baha'i faith strives to be recognized not as yet another religion to be added to the list of all these diverse religions, but it wants to be recognized as a modern religion that restates the truth that is enshrined in all these past religions. It wants to be recognized as a unifying force that instills into the hearts of its adherents a new spiritual vigor. It's a religion that wants to be recognized as infusing hope and love for mankind. And it wants to inspire a new vision of the fundamental unity of the religion. And finally, it wants to uphold a glorious destiny that is awaiting the entire human race. So one of the basic principles of the Baha'i faith to achieve this is for everyone to strive to abandon all kinds of prejudices, whether it is racial prejudice, gender prejudice, whether it is discrimination against one's language or one's culture or wealth or anything that divides us. So the Baha'i faith wants to promote racial unity, gender equality, ethnic and cultural diversity, and anything that brings harmony to the human race. In fact, it goes beyond all of these and tries to even bring harmony between religion and science. For over a century now, we have had a division between followers of religion and scientists, in the sense that followers of religion sometimes just do not accept the principles of science, and scientists consider religion to be superstition. From a Baha'i perspective, religion and science are two spheres of knowledge that have to work harmoniously with each other. One without the other will not allow the human civilization to grow and develop. I believe it was Einstein who said, religion without science is blind, science without religion is lame, or the other way around. And this particular framework requires us to have or develop a new vision for humanity. The first step is really for us to see each other in a different light. And here is what Baha'u'llah again said, and I would like to quote his word because it is very clear and specific. He says, man is the supreme talisman. Lack of a proper education hath, however, deprived him of that which he doth inherently possess. Regard man as a mine rich in gems of inestimable value. Education alone can cause it to reveal its treasures and enable mankind to benefit therefrom. How can we try to see each other as gems of inestimable value, as mines that are filled with gems of inestimable value? Because sometimes when we look at each other, we may dwell on our own differences. We may not dwell on our commonalities. And I think it is here that the Baha'i faith tries to develop a capacity for collaboration. From a Baha'i point of view, we all need each other, regardless of what we think, what we believe, the color of our skin, our height, our cultural background, the language that we speak. We all need each other to work together to try to build a new civilization, because there is a gem in each one of us that needs to be discovered. To end this portion of my presentation, I'd like to very briefly encapsulate the Baha'i faith in one paragraph. And this is from the Baha'i writings, which says, the Baha'i faith upholds the unity of God, recognizes the unity of his prophets, and inculcates the principle of the oneness and wholeness of the human race. It proclaims the necessity and the inevitability of the unification of mankind, asserts that it is gradually approaching, and claims that nothing short of the transmuting Spirit of God, working through his chosen mouthpiece in this day, can ultimately succeed in bringing it about. It moreover enjoins upon its followers the primary duty of an unfettered search after truth, condemns all manner of prejudice and superstition, declares the purpose of religion to be the promotion of amity and concord, proclaims its essential harmony with science, and recognizes it as the foremost agency for the pacification and the orderly progress of human society. It unequivocally maintains the principle of equal rights, opportunities, and privileges for men and women, insists on compulsory education, eliminates extremes of poverty and wealth, abolishes the institution of priesthood, prohibits slavery, asceticism, mendicancy, and monasticism, prescribes monogamy, discourages divorce, emphasizes the necessity of strict obedience to one's government, exalts any work performed in the spirit of service to the level of worship, urges either the creation or selection of an auxiliary international language, and delineates the outlines of those institutions that must establish and perpetuate the general peace of mankind. Now, we go to the land of its birth, to Iran, in the 21st century. The persecution of the Baha'is in Iran is nothing new. It has existed from its inception in the middle of the 19th century. More than 20,000 Baha'is, and prior to that, Babis, were put to death in the most cruel form of torture. Then, at the time of the Shah, in the Pahlavi regime, even though the persecution was relatively less than before, nonetheless it had continued. At that time, one of the Hujjatul Islams, one of the religious clergies, had gone on the pulpit in the 1950s and had called for the destruction of Baha'i properties and essentially the Baha'i community. Later on, there was an organization that was formed called Hujjatiyyah. And this organization's one purpose was the destruction of the Baha'i community. When the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini came to Iran, he banned this organization, strangely enough, because he thought that this particular organization, even though it was an anti-Baha'i organization, but that it had collaborated with the Pahlavi regime. So the Hujjatiyyah members went underground. It wasn't until about 5 or 7 years ago that this organization came back, and right now many of Iranian leaders actually belong to this particular organization. And since the beginning of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, more than 200 Baha'is have been executed. Thousands of Baha'is have been put in prison, tortured, intimidated. Hundreds of thousands of Baha'is have lost their homes, pensions, and salaries. Thousands of students have been deprived of their right to education. And even the dead Baha'is have not been immune from the attack of the Iranian government, as many cemeteries have been destroyed. And in fact, just about a month ago, we heard the news of a woman who died in Mashhad, in the northeastern part of Iran, whose body was not allowed to be buried because the Baha'i cemetery had been confiscated. And it took a month for the government to issue a burial permission or certificate. Now, we don't have time to go through the details of the persecution of the Baha'is, but suffice it to say that approximately 3 years ago, let me back up, in the beginning of the revolution, the Baha'i administrative machinery in Iran was banned, because in every country where there are Baha'is, they democratically elect an organization called the Spiritual Assembly. And the Baha'i community is led, and the affairs of the community is arranged and managed by these organizations. The Iranian government banned these organizations. So Baha'is had to educate their children. There were questions to be answered. So several individuals were asked to serve as volunteers, not as a formal Baha'i institutions, which of course exist in all the rest of the world, but as an ad hoc committee to attend to the affairs of the Baha'i community. For more than 20 years they were operating, until suddenly in 2008, Iranian authorities barged into their homes early in the morning and they arrested them without any warrants, without any official accusations, and took him to prison. For about 8 months, they were in solitary confinement. And even though the Iranian constitution specifically says that anyone who is arrested has to be informed in writing what their crime is, it took these individuals more than 8 months to be told what the charges are. And they were charged to become or to be spies of Israel. They were charged to have disturbed the national security of Iran. They were charged to have formed an illegal organization. They were charged to have contacted foreign governments in order to undermine the Iranian authority and a few other charges. Of course, the Baha'i international community has and continue to vehemently deny all of these charges because the Iranian government has not presented a shred of evidence to support any of these allegations. In fact, the first time these seven members of the Baha'i community in Iran, the first time they actually met their attorney was when they saw them in court 2 years after their imprisonment. They were deprived of the right to representation. And they had a show trial of about maybe a total of 5 hours in the form of three sessions or three or four sessions. And after that, they were convicted of 20 years of imprisonment. The Baha'i international community and their lawyers, and by the way, their lawyers were some Iranian attorneys led by Dr. Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Laureate, and it was her office that defended the Baha'is. And they appealed the decision to a higher court. Within days, the Court of Appeal reduced their sentence to 10 years, and they dropped six of the charges because they could not provide any evidence to the veracity of their claim. And only recently, as of about 2 weeks ago, the Prosecutor General of Iran has commuted that sentence back to 20 years because they said that the verdict of the appeals court has not been in accordance with the provision of the Islamic Sharia, even though it has been following the Iranian laws. So one of the challenges that not only the Baha'is but the international community is facing is that Iranian authorities essentially draw the Sharia card, which trumps every law in Iran. And I would like to just spend only a few minutes on discussing some of these charges. They charge Baha'is to be spies of Israel. And in some of the slides that you saw, in fact, the slogan say, death to Baha'i spies. And this charge essentially comes from the fact that Baha'i holy places and the Baha'i headquarters are situated in the country Israel. Well, going back a little bit to the history of the Baha'i faith, when Baha'u'llah declared his mission in the middle of the 19th century, two Islamic powers of the time, the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, decided to exile Baha'u'llah and his family to another country, at that time, the Ottoman Empire. So they were sent out of Iran at first to where is now Baghdad, and then from there further out to Constantinople and then Adrianople. And then Baha'u'llah was imprisoned at that time to a penal colony, which is now Akka, Israel. Baha'u'llah passed away 80 years prior to the formation of the State of Israel. And of course, he was buried in that land. So Baha'is essentially considering that a sacred land essentially built their holy places there. So this allegation that the Baha'is of spies of Israel is based on a historical fact that Baha'is have been there at least 80 years, if not more than 100 years, prior to the formation of the State of Israel. And secondly, if just a simple presence of Baha'is, if the juxtaposition of the Baha'i community in Israel, or the Baha'i administration in Israel, is to be construed as being spies of Israel, then by that logic, which is not valid in my opinion, All the Muslims of the world are also spies of Israel. Why? Because the second holiest mosque in the Islamic world, the Masjid al-Aqsa, is also in Israel. And by that same logic, all the Muslims must be the spies of Iraq because Najaf and Karbala are two of the holiest cities for the Shia Muslims. So as you can see, this particular charge is beyond reason, in fact is bordering ridiculous, because it is not only the Baha'i leaders, but the entire Baha'i community in Iran, the 300,000 Baha'i community membership in Iran is suddenly a spies, from a child all the way to an old person. During the time of the revolution, an 80-year-old person was executed for being a spy of Israel when this person could not read and write, and this person had not set foot outside of his village. And finally, Baha'is are deprived of right to employment. They cannot work for the government, and they cannot also work in the private sector. The Iranian government has gone out and threatened private companies to fire their Baha'i employees. Otherwise, they would close down that business. So essentially, Baha'is have been barred from any means of subsistence legally. And then the question is, if Baha'is cannot even work for the government, how would they possibly have any access to the most secret documents that the Iranian government must have for Baha'is to actually somehow obtain it and send it to Israel? So these are, of course, the defense lines of the attorneys who try to impress upon the Iranian courts that the Baha'is are innocent of all of these charges, and there is one reason and only one reason that the Baha'is are being harassed, arrested, intimidated, imprisoned, and that's because they are Baha'is. It is purely and simply because of their beliefs. We have collected a significant amount of documents, thousands of documents, from the beginning of the revolution that the Iranian officials have submitted to the Baha'is, in which it says, because you belong to the, quote, misguided sect of Baha'ism, you are dismissed from your job, you are dismissed from university, you are not allowed to have a business. And we have documentations that, in fact, one of the special rapporteurs of the United Nations has collected, which in 1993 he obtained this confidential document, and he brought it to the United Nations, and we saw it, in which it shows that the persecution of the Baha'is is systematic and sanctioned at the highest level of Iranian authorities by no less than the supreme leader currently, Ayatollah Khamenei. And in this, I just, with the time that I have, I read only a few lines of this. It says that the Baha'is, for example, the Baha'is must be expelled from universities either in the admission process or during the course of their studies, once it becomes known that they are Baha'is. A plan must be devised to confront and destroy their cultural roots outside the country. Propaganda institutions must establish an independent section to counter the propaganda and religious activities of the Baha'is. As I monitor the Iranian media, there is not one day, ladies and gentlemen, when there is not some sort of attack, either in websites or in radio or in television, against the Baha'is. And when the Baha'is go to the government authorities trying to respond to these attacks, they are not even allowed to enter the organization. So Baha'is cannot defend themselves against these. There have been other documents that have been obtained, for example, one by Asma Jahangir, another rapporteur of the United Nations for Freedom of Religion and Belief, in which we see that other high government officials from different ministries, they have asked other ministries to collect information about the Baha'is, about who they are, their names, addresses, phone numbers, where they work, number of children, all kinds of detailed information, which calls to mind what the Nazi Germany was doing to the Jews. There are documents that we have which shows that the Iranian government is not allowed to issue business license to Baha'is, especially, they say, if it has to do with serving food, because Baha'is are najis, unclean, and therefore if they sell you the food, then you become najis and unclean. And the story is very long. Unfortunately, I don't have time to explain more of this, but it all boils down to one thing. It all boils down to the fact that the Iranian authorities have created this monster that is called the Others. And the Others include the Baha'is, the Christians, the Jews, the Zoroastrians, the Sufis, the journalists, the students. Anyone who thinks differently than the official perspective of Islam, and that's of the specific variety, the Shia Islam, and even that of a specific variety of the 12th or Imamate Shia, which means that they believe in 12 Imams and they're waiting for the return of the 12th Imam to come and fill the world with justice and fairness. And of course, we have seen different versions of it from the Iranian president, who talks about it at the floor of the United Nations addressing the General Assembly. So it is our hope that the Baha'i faith that tries to teach oneness and wholeness of humanity in its huge and beautiful diversity can somehow counter this concept of otherness that unfortunately being widely spread in the land of its birth. Thank you so much for your patience.
Our thanks to Dr. Farhad Sabatan, spokesperson for the international Baha'i community in the United States, for his comments. I'm Michael Pappas, executive director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council. I'll be moderating today's audience question period. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to the Baha'i Faith with Dr. Farhad Sabatan. If the audience will indulge me, I'd like to take the moderator's prerogative and ask a question. And it's a personal question. Your Baha'i faith, what role did it play in going into the profession that you've gone into and answering the call you've answered as an economist? And what does the Baha'i faith say about the current economic crisis?
Well, thank you for that question. I actually could spend another hour talking about that because I'm somewhat passionate about what is happening in our economic situation today. I was a teenager when I decided to study economics, and it was motivated by a Baha'i principle which encourages the world and humanity to eliminate the extremes of poverty and wealth. We are living in a world that the gap between the rich and the poor is widening day by day. In fact, we are about 42 times more desperate in terms of the distance between rich and poor than 20 years ago. And that means that we have the richest person in the world with $40 or $50 billion of net worth, where there are people on earth whose annual salary is about maybe $100. Now, this type of injustice cannot continue, and it is this injustice that, in my opinion, is the cause of a lot of the economic issues that we have. So, essentially, the basic message of the Baha'i faith about economics is that economics is a science, and it has certain principles. But these principles have to be moderated by ethics and certain moral norms. And when we abandon those moral norms, then we confront ourselves with significant problems. The most recent economic crisis, which in 2007, in the classes I teach, I predicted, you know, to my students, we are in a recession. It took about more year later for the National Economic Research Organization to declare that it was a recession. And it was because of the greed of individuals who essentially did not care about individuals, households who have certain mortgages and what they were doing with it. So, of course, it is not part of economic science to dwell on morality. But in the last 20 years or so, many economists have in fact come back to re-examine the basic assumptions. One of the top economists who won the Nobel Prize, Amartya Sen, has written extensively about economics and ethics and what role ethics plays in making economics sustainable. So that was my motivation, and again, there's a lot to say about that.
You've satisfied my curiosity. This person asks the question, in your role as the spokesperson for the international Baha'i community, although there are a lot of Baha'i youth as well as other human rights activists in prison, why is the international Baha'i community only focusing on the seven prisoners known as, is it the Yaron?
The Yaron, that's right. Actually, at the United Nations, the Baha'i international community does work towards the release of all Iranian prisoners, and not only prisoners, but any Baha'i whose civil and human rights have been violated. And in fact, I'd like to go even further, that for the past 25 years, the Baha'i international community has worked with other human rights organizations, including the General Assembly, to actually press the international community to pass resolution against Iran's severe human rights violations. So that includes all the other religions, and it includes anyone whose right has been violated. Nonetheless, the emphasis on these seven individuals has been because they are used by the Iranian government as a symbol, and they have suffered the most severe form of imprisonment. 8 months in solitary confinement is only easy to just speak about. I don't know how many, I hope none of you ever even experienced one day of solitary confinement. But on top of that, being exposed to deprivation, many of these individuals are older, and they have medical requirements. They are not well physically. And frankly, it really doesn't matter. They are human beings. And therefore, there is no reason, as the Iranian government has not shown any reason, why they should be in prison even for 1 hour. So for the Baha'is, they are using these seven individuals as a symbol of the entire Iranian community. We need to take note of the fact that when these seven Iranian Baha'is were accused of being spies, at that time, not many other Iranians were being accused. It wasn't until later 2008 when there was the uprising, and suddenly all the students suddenly became spies of other governments, journalists became the spies of other governments, Iranian intellectuals, and many others, anyone who thought differently, they followed the same fate as these Baha'is. So, and also the Baha'i international community has more specific information about what is happening to these individuals. So, if there is more, they are essentially symbols of violation of human rights in Iran.
Thank you. The next question comes from a person's personal perspective, and yet I think it begs some larger issues. This person says, in the 60s and the 70s, I knew several Baha'is who tried to convert me. Mm-hmm. Do Baha'is still try hard to convert people, or have they moderated their policy to convert people of other faiths? And I think, using Western paradigms and terms, this would beg questions regarding to missionary work and evangelism.
Right. Proselytizing is forbidden in the Baha'i faith. So if some eager Baha'is gave the impression, I apologize. Baha'is do have a message, however, to share with others. And that message is, as I mentioned, it's a message of oneness and unity. Whether or not an individual wishes at some point to become a Baha'i is not of great concern for Baha'is. What is of great concern for us is for us to accept each other and work together in collaboration, regardless of what belief we have. Because the world right now is in sufficient degree of division and strife and animosity and hatred that it requires us to come together and work together to rebuild it. And rebuild it we will, not because we want to make ourselves homogeneous and the same, but through our diversity. You know, we want to have different opinions to work together so that we can figure out how we should, for example, deal with this world situation right now that is happening in the Middle East. Because, you know, the people of the world are showing that they're dissatisfied with their governments. Even in the United States, there are individuals who are showing that they're not satisfied with the economic condition. And we can only solve these problems together, regardless of who we are and what we are. So Baha'is go around and try to share this message with anyone who is willing to collaborate with them without having to convert or change the religion. And at any point, if they want to change the religion, that is their choice. Because Baha'is respect the choice of individuals to make. In fact, that's one of the first principles of the Baha'i faith, for anyone to investigate the truth for themselves without any prejudice and without any sense of biasness. And that's what we encourage.
Excellent. You spoke about oppression in general terms and in extreme terms. But this person asks the question, are Baha'is allowed to vote in Iran? Can they leave Iran at their own free will?
They definitely can leave Iran at their free will. And yes, they are allowed to vote, as Baha'is everywhere in the world are allowed to vote. The Baha'i administration does not compel anyone to vote, but Baha'is are free to vote. And in fact, I'm glad that question was asked, is because the Iranian government has used this permission to vote as a sign that Baha'is are trying to undermine the politics of Iran. And all they're doing is exercising their civil rights just like anyone else. Okay? When Baha'is vote, they vote as nonpartisan, because Baha'is do not get involved in partisan politics. Therefore, they can vote. Baha'is are allowed to vote, and they're encouraged to vote and perform their civil duties based on who they think can serve the country the best.
Okay. The next question kind of dovetails a question that I had. The person asks, is there a big Baha'i community in the United States? Are they active in the Bay Area? And I would just ask you to add to that, what is it like to be a minority religion in a country where you're not being persecuted? And you live among ancient faiths and this. So what is that like? But please tell us how the extent of the community in the States and the Bay Area.
Yeah, there are about 130,000 to 140,000 Baha'is in the United States, about 5,000 or 6,000 in the Bay Area. As might have been mentioned earlier, the Baha'i faith is the second most widespread religion, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, after Christianity. And so the Baha'is are all over the place, even though there are about 6 million Baha'is in the world, but they are spread. What is it like to be a minority in a country other than Iran? Frankly, it feels really good. It feels good in the sense that here, the most important thing, what is valued the most, is the exercise of human volition. What makes us human? That consciousness that we can actually make a choice. So here, Baha'is cherish that freedom that they have been given to exercise the religion, which is very precious for them, and they are deprived of exercising that in the land where this religion was born. And they only wish to actually promote that and make sure that everywhere in the world that is the case. And not only for the Baha'is, but anyone who wants to exercise that free will to choose what they believe is the truth.
Thank you. I think one of the wonderful things about our San Francisco Interfaith Council, it's an opportunity for people who don't know about other people's faiths to experience them firsthand. For instance, we have the second Thursday of every month a gathering, and we encourage people to pray the way they pray so others can learn. A question that was asked here, could you describe a typical Sunday service for Baha'is? What if I walked into your temple on Valencia Street, which I have, what could I expect?
Yes. What Baha'is have for the Baha'i communities, every 19 days, the Baha'is get together in what is called a 19-day feast, and they have a devotion, and they read Baha'i writings, and they also talk about their community. That is actually considered to be an institution, a democratic institution, where Baha'is are supposed to talk about how they can make their community better, how they can live with their neighbors better, and how can they actually strengthen that bond of friendship. Baha'is also invite others to have devotions with them. In fact, this is a principle, a very pivotal idea for Baha'i houses of worship, of which there are a number of them in the world. And all of these houses of worship have nine sides, symbolizing the nine main religions coming together with their own language and with their own spirit to worship God the way they want in one place. So Baha'i houses of worship are open to all, to Buddhists, to Hindus, to Muslims, to Christians, to anyone, as an act of collective worship, because that collective worship is very precious for the Baha'is. And they are now going around to and inviting their friends to just come together and have devotions. This is one of the things that Baha'is do throughout the world right now.
What impressed me during my visit was really the emphasis on music and classical music and contemporary music. It was a very interesting experience, and I'd encourage others who have not been to come and see. This might have been covered in your talk, but perhaps worthy of reiteration. What are the roots of Baha'i persecution in Iran, and why was the community targeted, and did the founder and prophet do something to provoke this?
Right. What I might not have emphasized in my presentation is that the Baha'i faith believes that religion is progressive in nature, mm-hmm. that the divine revelation never ends, that God's bounties will continue forever and ever, ever, through his representatives, through the God's representative, which we refer to as prophets, and in the Baha'i terminology, we refer to them as manifestations of God. So when Baha'u'llah appeared, he declared that he is a new manifestation of God. And in fact, he declared that he is the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the past. And since he appeared in Iran, the government and the clergy at that time vehemently opposed him because of their interpretation of Islam, that after Muhammad, there should be no other prophet. And therefore, from their perspective, it was a heresy for someone to come and declare to have another religion. Even today, they are accusing Baha'is of having a new, inventing a new religion. The Baha'is, even though they are the second largest minority in Iran after Sunni Muslims, they are not mentioned in the Iranian constitution because the Iranian government does not consider the Baha'is to be a religion. Even though in all comparative religion textbooks, the Baha'i faith is considered a religion by all criteria. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the animosity and the hatred has theological roots in the sense that because they believe that after Muhammad, there is no religion and there is no prophet, therefore Baha'is have violated that. And also, the Baha'i faith is progressing very rapidly in Iran. And the Baha'i faith has sort of substituted a democratically elected institution to perform the priestly function. So there is no one individual, not one clergy that does that. And every year these individuals change. Well, for a country that is run by the clergy, that may be very threatening. In fact, that was this whole uprising, that's what it was about, because people ask, where is my vote? That I want to vote who is going to be my government, who is going to represent me. Well, that has existed in the Baha'i structure over 100 and some odd years ago. In other words, Baha'u'llah brought this principle of democracy and voting and selecting who you want to lead your community. And that these are some of the reasons that the Baha'is are being opposed.
I guess this is a follow-up question, because this person asks, why are the clergy in Iran against the Baha'is? And we've spoken of political persecution, but you just made reference to the clerical persecution. What kind of a role do the clergy play in influencing the political process
in Iran?
In Iran,
pretty much everything. In other words, in Iran, the society is divided into two broad segments, the mujtahids and the muqallids. The muqallids are the imitators, and the mujtahid are those who are leading the imitators. So in Iran, therefore, the mujtahids run everything, whether they are a Hujjatul Islam, which is like a bishop, or ayatollahs, which is almost like a pope, and they have their own followers, and sometimes they disagree with each other, which in fact is one of the major political issues in Iran. So it is unfortunate that Iran does not have a well-defined policy for the government, because different clergies have different dictates and different fatwas. One clergy makes one fatwa, another clergy makes another fatwa, and they may be very opposite to each other. And the people just follow either this one or that one. So that's why, as far as the foreign policies of other governments, they don't know really who are they dealing with and how they should respond to specific issues that come up in that country.
There were a number of other questions that were put to us here. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get to all of them, but we thank those who asked the question. Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. And because we've spent a lot of time talking about Iran, I'd like to end with something that's a little more global and universal. What are the Baha'is doing to promote the concept of justice on the global scale?
Very good question. Justice, Baha'u'llah has said, is the best beloved of all things in my sight. Justice places prominently in the Baha'i faith in such a way that those local institutions that I mentioned are referred to as houses of justice. And it's a very deep and profound concept that I'm afraid I will not be able to cover in 30 seconds. All I have to say is that from a Baha'i point of view, justice means balance, means bringing these diverse people together so that the body can stay whole and it can grow and flourish. Since the time is over, I was also asked to present the Interfaith Council with a gift from the Baha'i community of San Francisco, and I would like to present that to you as a token of the Baha'i community's appreciation for this session.
Thank you, Dr. Our library is like a garden for me, and when I want to pick off a fruit, I just pull a volume, and this is going to be wonderful reading. Our very special thanks to Dr. Farhad Sabatan for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 107 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.